same thing. Infinity, one shall own, that shall own. Nowhere she lives. Her spirit was everywhere. In distant constellations, we around her. Earth saw her bones. All worlds were her colony. The greater worlds of life and might were hers. All nature opened her in its light. Its movements were large copies of her own. She was the single self of all these things. She was in them, and they were all in her.
Good morning, everyone. We're coming to the end of the book of Yoga. We have just the last page of Canto 7 to read, starting on page 557. But before we start reading, I just want to let you know, to inform you about some special events that are happening in Savitri Bhavan over this month. Special events for the special birthday month. So from next Monday, February 15th, there'll be a very special and very beautiful exhibition of paintings by Hooter, visionary paintings. These are not paintings connected with Savitri. These are paintings executed over quite many years, starting from 1956. Visions that she had herself and painted, or visions that the mother had and instructed her to paint. So that those will be in the square hall here. And because these are original paintings, we have to have attendance there. So the opening hours will be only 10 to 12 and 2 to 5 daily. Here I've written except Sundays, but I think it will be open not next Sunday, but the Sunday after. That's Monday, February 15th to Wednesday, March 2nd. Then the following Friday, the 19th of February, we'll be holding in the amphitheater the 6th Dr. Nadkarni Memorial Lecture. And this year the talk is being given by Jamshed Mavalwala, who was a close friend of Dr. Nadkarni and compiled an obituary, book of obituary tributes to him, and who is quite active with the Sri Aurobindo Society and the Beach Office in Pondi. And he's been doing some research on the three themes of aspiration, surrender, and rejection. And he's chosen for the topic of his talk, the topic of surrender, particularly as it is treated in the poem, Savitri. But he'll also be sharing with us some other quotations from Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So that'll be 4 to 5 in the amphitheater, Friday, 19th February. The UHU series, University of Human Unity series of programs, is coming to an end at the end of the month. And they would like to celebrate that with another solo violin performance by Ladislav Brosman. They do this every year. He'll be playing in the picture gallery, 5 p.m., Saturday, 27th of February, two solo sonatas for violin, Bach sonata in D minor and Isaiah's fifth sonata. On the 28th of February, traditionally after the bonfire, Rosa has always organized a get-together for Russian visitors on some special topic. And this year they have invited Dr. Alok Pandey to speak about the supramental manifestation, because this year is one of those exceptional years when we celebrate the recurrence of 29th February 1956. So he is going to give a talk which has that title, The Day of the Lord, February 29th, 1956. And that talk will take place after the bonfire in our amphitheater, in the Savitri Bhavan Amphitheater, 7:45 to 8:30. And on that special day itself, a French I'm not sure whether she's a newcomer or an Aurovillian, Céline Devaux, is offering in French, a program in French, Douze Prières et Méditations de la Mère. and she'll be doing that as a kind of small performance. She will recite and present these 12. And that will be, in Savitri Bhavan Amphitheatre, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. on the 29th of February. So posters will be going up. Unfortunately, they are not up today, but from tomorrow they should be up. And it'll be in the news also. So we have come to the culmination of Savitri's yoga, page 557. The canto is called The Cosmic Spirit and the Cosmic Consciousness. After the whole course of these seven cantos, this quite longish book, Savitri has reached this culmination where she experiences, her spirit sees the world as living God. And we read everything except just the very last page. Paula read that very beautifully for us last week, but now we can look at it in more detail. Shall we start at the back? Praveen, would you start? Page 557 at the top.
Out of the infinitude, all came to her. Into the infinitude, sentient she spread. Infinity was her own natural home. Nowhere she dwelt, her spirit was everywhere. The distant constellations wheeled around her. Earth saw her born. All worlds were her colonies. The greater worlds of life and mind were hers. All nature reproduced her in its lines. Its movements were large copies of her own. She was a single cell of all these cells. She was in them, and they were all in her.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask or share anything about these lines? I think if you look in the dictionary, you may not find this word infinitudes. It is one of the words that Sri Aurobindo has introduced into the English language. All the great poets have done this and coined new words and made them usable in English. And we could say that it means infinitenesses, no? But it sounds much more poetic than that. And at the same time, the structure of the word in English, if we are familiar with English literature, the meaning is clear, infinitude. Yes, it's like certitude. I mean, it's the same sort of ending. Mm? Is that what you wanted to say?
I don't know. It was written, I think, to talk about this.
Well, perhaps as a parallel example, yes. A way that we can form words.
There is another parallel word recently coined. 5 years ago, maybe even more, it's called, instead of universe, they discovered there are many universes, now they call it multiverse.
The multiverse, yes. So like that, in a living language, there are always new words being coined. Particularly the poets do it, but also the scientists do it, yes. And the people involved with developing new technology, there's all the time. So the people who maintain dictionaries, they have to keep them up to date. But particularly there's the famous Oxford English Dictionary, based on historical principles, and they not only give a definition of the word, but they give examples of its use from the very first use, first traced use in English literature. So I don't know whether infinitudes has got in yet, but definitely they have to attribute it to Sri Aurobindo. He's the first one to use it. Yeah.
It's the strangeness of the English language, that infinitude and infinitesimal have a similarity, but yet are so vastly different.
And infinitesimal is, of course, an adjective, so how would you make a noun out of it? There is a noun, infinitesimals.
It is infinitesimal. No, I'm just saying the sort of
nouns. Nouns, Don. Yeah. Anyway, let's not get too technical. So this is Savitri's experience. That experience is coming to her. Everything is coming to her out of the infinite expanses of existence, and she herself, her consciousness is spreading out, sentient. She's feeling and experiencing all that infinity was her own natural home. And she's not tied down to any particular location in it, nowhere she dwelt. Her spirit is extended everywhere, inhabiting all that. But at the same time, there's a feeling of the most distant constellations, the stars, that she experiences them as herself as a center, that they are moving around her. And then there's this line, "Earth saw her born." So she's been born as a human being here on earth. The phrase may have a deeper meaning, but we can stick with that one for the time being. But through this expansion of her consciousness, through the practice of yoga, all the worlds have become her colonies. She's a colony is... Of course, nowadays in modern history, it's become a rather negative word.
Yeah.
But the original idea was when the world was more sparsely populated, less overpopulated, the way that the Greek culture spread all around the Mediterranean, or the Phoenician culture, it was because cities, as they grew, as they expanded, in some cases, every 7 years, they had the custom of selecting the brightest and best beautiful young people, boys and girls, and giving them a ship or some ships loaded with supplies and instructions, and they were to go out and find a suitable place and found a city there. And that was a way of spreading the... civilizing influence, we could say, but definitely the culture that they had come from. So I think it's in this sense that she's spreading her atmosphere, her knowledge, into all the worlds. I think this means not only the worlds of the physical universe, but the psychological planes of existence, the vital worlds, the mental worlds, the higher subtle worlds. And that's what it says in the next line, no? The greater worlds of life and mine were hers. And here in the material universe, it says, if all nature reproduced her in its lines, as if she finds herself copied, expressed in the forms and movements of nature. All nature reproduced her in its lines. Do you think that's what artists should do? Yeah. Okay. So its movements, the movements of nature, were larger copies of her own. She feels herself to be the single uniting self of all these many, many innumerable selves. and there's a reciprocal relationship. She was in them, and they were all in her.
She opened the path to two major realizations. One is discovering everything in oneself, and then seeing oneself in everything. This is something similar to it?
Yes. This is from Isha Upanishad.
Hmm.
And actually it's three realizations. If I can remember the words.
Is the Nirvana which came in between?
All in God, God in all.
All as God.
All as God, yes. God.
And oneself as God, as everything.
I think this definition of unity with the divine.
Integral union with the divine. Yes. With the divine in the three forms, transcendent, cosmic, and individual. Individual.
When all individuals are considered like this, for me that is the divine.
That would be the fulfillment of the whole evolutionary process. No, when all this is conscious in this way.
Not only one,
but for the individual, this is a wonderful fulfillment. Yeah. Would you read, Mary?
She was a substance in life.
No, wait a moment. Line 221, this first. Let's pause there. She had been feeling, in the first expansion of her consciousness, her identity, made her feel that she was nothing and null, no one and null, no, a vanishing vestige like a violet trace. But now that violet trace has expanded and experienced another much vaster identity with everything. If we look carefully at this last section, we can see that it happens step by step. There's an expansion of her own consciousness. But then she sees the union of the transcendent and the cosmic. The universe was his body, God its soul, this of this individual, top of page 536. An individual, one with cosmic self. Sorry, 556, just on the previous page, yes. An individual, one with cosmic self, in the heart of the transcendence miracle and the secret of world personality, was the Creator and the Lord of all. Mind, life, the universe was his body, God its soul. All was one single immense reality, and everything in the universe is its innumerable phenomenon, all expressions of that reality. So then there's, first she sees that, and then there's the beginning of an identification. Her spirit saw the world as living God. This is the first of the realizations mentioned in Isha Upanishad. It saw the One and knew that all was He. And she follows him. She can understand him like that. She followed him through the march of endless time. But then there's a closer identification. All nature's happenings were events in her. The heartbeats of the cosmos were her own. All beings thought and felt and moved in her. So she's experiencing the cosmic consciousness.
Then all in God,
no? Yes, but in her, he in whom it has become, yes. So then she has this experience of everything coming to her out of the infinite expanses, and she's spreading out, and at the same time the awareness that she's been born on earth and she has had this expansion, and she's become the single self of all these selves. She was in them and they were all in her. And that is expanded in the lines which Marie read. How does this feel like? You identify with the whole, with the subconscious life of trees and flowers. This, I think, must be a very wonderful identification which the mother has expressed in some of her prowess and prayers and meditations. For example, the one of becoming, identifying with the cherry tree in Japan. Mm-hmm. And this very beautiful line, 225, the outbreak of the honeyed buds of spring. This is a very poetic spelling of the word honeyed. Yeah. So, yes, all those beautiful buds breaking out, they are going to flower. That's a kind of subconscious life. From there, she climbs and identifies with mind, with the human world. She was thought and the passion of the world's heart and all the aspiration of human beings, no? The Godhead hid in the heart of man, and the climbing, the evolutionary development of the soul towards union with the divine. She has the experience as if she's a wonderful flower bed, and out of which all the forms of the cosmos, of the universe, are flowering. She identifies with time and all these wonderful things which happen in the successions of time, the dreams of God in time. She identifies with his extension in space. But back on line 221, it says, this first was an immense identity. It's not the ultimate that comes in the last four lines. Marianne, would you read the last four lines at the bottom?
From this she arose, where time time and space were not. The superconscient was her native air. Infinity was her movement's natural space. Eternity looked out from her on time.
This is the identification with the transcendent state. We could say this is the experience of living in the Parabrahman. Parabrahman. There's the silent Brahman and there's the dynamic Brahman, and beyond that there's the supreme being, the Parabrahman.
Especially the last part, when it comes to me, the understanding why Shri Aurobindo lies in letters of yoga always, be open to the mother, ne? Because she is all, she's in all the parts of the creation and in being and in us. Ne?
Yes. And above all, she's the Shakti, she's the dynamic aspect.
Obviously, mother was going through this experience, right? And when you have this kind of consciousness, you cease to be a human, and that's what we felt attracted to, that's what made people recognize her, because she was not in, she lost her identity, and I was wondering how she can function as a human being.
Well, the amazing thing was that she was operating on all the three levels, the transcendent level, the cosmic level, the earth, the level of the whole earth, and still there she was, this sweet, dear, loving mother looking after all of her children as individuals. I didn't have that very close personal contact with her, but somebody once explained it to me that she was superhuman in this sense. She was most intensely human, all the beautiful things that humanity represents, intimacy and affection and clarity, and, and as an ideal human being, she embodied all that.
I did a lot of interviews with old Sarats, also with Asta, and it's amazing what they are telling. Yeah, I mean, I only had time to listen to a few. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
So the book of yoga started on page 465, and now we've come to page 557. So not quite, just short of 100 lines, 100 pages. And when we come to the end of book 7, there's one more book in this second part of the poem. When Sri Aurobindo first began to write Savitri, the earliest known version that we have was found in two exercise books, and the two parts were of similar length. And in that very first version, there's no title given, but in a letter he wrote later, he said that there was in two parts. The first part was about earth, and the second part was about beyond. So now we're coming to the last book of the earth section, and that's the book of death. And then comes the third part, part three, books 9 to 12, which tell about the beyond. This is now not equal in length to the earlier part. Sri Aurobindo expanded the earlier part immensely, particularly part one, which ends at the end of book three. And then there comes the story, Savitri's story, basically. It starts with the birth of Savitri, and ends with the death of Satyavan.
When did
you
start? The beyond start where?
The beyond starts at the beginning of book 9. Because this part doesn't take place on earth, it takes place in the subtle realms. The first part, that's the part that Sri Aurobindo expanded most. And there's the first two cantos, the dawning of the day, Savitri waking up on the day when Satyavan must die. And then there's a canto, brief canto, about Savitri, giving a hint about her mission and who she is. And then we come to canto 3 of book 1, the story of Asvapati starts. It says, a world's desire compelled her mortal birth. How did Savitri come into the world to fulfill the world's desire? This is a result of the yoga of her father, King Asvapati. And this is the part that got expanded most in the late 1930s. That very first version is less than 2,000, of 1916, is less than 2,000 words. And in 1937, early 1938, there was a version which went from there up to the beginning of, up to the end of book 3. They covered the whole of part 1. And that was also about 2,000-3,000 lines. But now, that's over 11,000 lines.
Yeah. And what is the title for this first part?
It doesn't have a part. It's just called part 1.
Yeah, just part 1. And what you would mean to give it the title, like Earth and Beyond?
This is the time... The prologue, in a way, this is the work of Asvapati, and at the very end of book 3, there's the promise from the Supreme Divine Mother that one shall descend, and then part 2 starts with the birth of Savitri, and it's her whole story, growing up and going out and falling in love and getting married and practicing yoga, and it continues now in the next book, which we're going to read, which tells of the death of Satyavan. We'll read it now. And what is very interesting is that this is the shortest book. It's just 10 pages. And I've been comparing the earliest version to the complete version. So here in this little bit here, only 47 lines have been added from the very first version. Mm-hmm. So this is a part that was least revised. And Nirod Baran has told us about this, that when they were doing the revision, putting everything together in 1950, they came actually to the end of book 6. Book 7 was newly composed. It was not present at all in the earliest version. It was composed in 1946 and 47. So that was all complete, and they were revising in book 6. And when they came to the end of book 6, Sri Aurobindo dictated some very powerful extra lines which come near the end. This was in the middle of November 1950. And he asked Nirod, who was helping him keep all these papers organized and so on, he said, is that all? And Nirod says, there's still the Book of Death and the Epilogue, Book 12. And Sri Aurobindo said, we'll see about that later. But he knew very well that he wasn't going to see about it later. So Nirod takes it that this is Sri Aurobindo's, he says, his seal of incomplete completion. It was not fully complete, but it was complete enough that he could leave it. He could leave it as the record, the supreme revelation of his vision. And that's why I find the quarrels that sometimes go on about textual differences between the different editions are more or less irrelevant. There's enough here for us. And if there's a comma out of the place or a word misspelled or something like that, that shouldn't make a big difference to us. So, Canto 3, Death in the Forest. There's a footnote. The Book of Death was taken from Canto 3 of an early version of Savitri, apparently from the 1920s. That early version of Savitri had only 6 cantos and an epilogue. It was slightly revised at a late stage. 18 lines were added at a late stage, and a number of new lines were added. But it was never fully worked into the final version of the poem. This is the opinion of the editors. So its original designation, Canto 3, has been retained as a reminder of this. But there's nothing missing. It's very, very interesting that if we have a look at the first known version, the bits that we find retained in the last version, they're all in the same order. He hasn't shuffled things around. He's made additions, huge expansions. He's revised the level of the poetry up to the highest that he could achieve. But it's recognizably the same poem. And the events happen in the same order, and nothing has got left out. So this first 11 lines of this canto here take us back to the morning of the day when Satyavan must die. That is right back to Canto 2 at the beginning. Canto 2, the issue, back to page 11. And it's interesting to compare the imagery in these first lines with the imagery in the first page of Canto 2. The last line of Canto 1 is, "This was the day when Satyavan must die." So we go back to that. We're back to the morning of the day when Satyavan must die. This is page
561. Do you have any idea whether the date that Sheridan wrote that line, this was the day?
No, I think Richard Hartz can tell us this. He's got all the manuscripts, he's gone through them. But it came fairly early on. Which line are you looking for?
Is it the day that the
That is not in here.
It's a
there. Okay. So, Lorraine, you will read?
Death in the Forest. Now it was here in this great golden dawn. By her still sleeping husband laying, she gazed into her past as one about to die, looks back upon the sunlit fields of life. For he too ran and sported with the rest, lifting his head above the huge dark stream into whose depths he was forever plunged. All she had been and done, she lived again. The whole year in a swift and eddying race. A memory swept through her and fled away. into irrecoverable past.
Yes.
Okay.
Recovery. Yes.
Then silence.
No, let's pause there.
Okay.
Oh no, we're just reading this canto. Please go on. Yes. We go with, yes.
Then silently she rose and, service done, bowed down to the great goddess simply carved by Satyavan upon a forest stone. What prayer she breathed her soul and Durga knew. Perhaps she felt in the dim forest hue the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps she shrouded voice spoke something. Perhaps the shrouded voice spoke some still word. At last she came to the pale mother queen. She spoke but with guarded lips and tranquil face. Lest some stray word or some betraying look should let pass into the mother's unknowing breast, slaying all happiness and need to live a dark foreknowledge, a dire foreknowledge of the grief to come. Only the needed utterance passage found. All else she pressed back into her anguished heart, and forced upon her speech an outward peace.
Thank you. Thank you. Lady next to you, Marie. Will you read?
No.
No? No? Okay. Larry?
One year that I have lived with Satyavan, here on the emerald edge of the vast woods, in the iron ring of the enormous peaks, under the blue rifts of the forest sky. I have not gone into the silences of this great woodland that enringed my thoughts with mystery, nor in its green miracles wandered. But this small clearing was my world. Now has a strong desire seized all my heart to go with Satyavan, holding his hand, into the life that he has loved, and touch herbs he had trod, and know the forest flowers, and hear at ease the birds and the scurrying life that starts and ceases, rich far rustle of boughs, and all the mystic whispering of the woods. Release me now, and let my heart have rest. She answered, do as thy wise mind desires. O calm child sovereign with the eyes that rule, I hold thee for a strong goddess who has come, pitying our barren days. So dost thou serve, even as a slave might, yet art thou beyond all that thou doest, all our minds conceive, like the strong sun that serves earth from above.
Thank you. Who will read?
Then the doomed husband and the woman who knew went with lean hands
into that solendo, where beauty and grandeur and unspoken dreams, where nature's mystic silence could be felt, coming with the secrecy of God. Beside her Satyavan worked full of joy because she moved with him through his green home. He showed her all the forests, riches, flowers, innumerable of every odor and hue, and soft, thick, clinging peoples, red and green, and strange, rich, plumaged birds. To every cry that haunted, sweetly distant boughs replied with the shrill singer's name more sweetly called. He spoke of all the things he loved. They were his boyhood's comrades and his playfellows, quavers and companions of his life here in this world whose every mood he knew. Their thoughts which to the common mind are blank, he shared to every wild emotion felt and answered. Deeply she listened, but to hear the voice that soon will cease from tender words and treasure its sweet cadences beloved for lonely memory when known by her word, and the beloved voice would speak no more.
Thank you.
Yes.
You read.
But little dwelt her mind upon their sense of death, not life she thought, or life's lone end. Love in her bosom heard with jagged edges of anguish moaned at every step with pain, crying, now perhaps his voice will cease forever. Even by some vague touch of rest, sometimes her eyes looked round as if their orbs might see the dim and dreadful god's approach. But Satyavan had cause. He meant to finish his labor here, that happy, linked, uncaring, they too might wander free in the green, deep, primeval mystery of the forest heart. Worldless, but near.
Different book.
Another version.
Primeval mystery of the forest heart. A tree that raised its tranquil head to heaven, luxuriating in verdure, summoning the breeze with amorous wideness of its boughs. He chose, and with his steel azale, the arm brawn, rope and strong hidden in its emerald dress. Worldless, but near she watched, no turn to lose of the bright face and body which she loved. Her life was now in seconds, not in hours, and every moment she
economized.
Like a pale merchant leaned above his store, the miser of his poor remaining gold.
Thank you. Do you like to read, ma'am? Dera.
But Satyavan yielded a joyous axe. He sang high snatches of a sage's chant. The field of conquered death is slain, and sometimes paused to cry to her sweet speech of love and mockery tenderer than love. She like a panthress leaped upon his words and carried them into her cavern heart. But as he worked, his doom upon him came. The violent and hungry hounds of pain traveled through his body, biting as they passed silently, and all his suffering breast besieged strove to rend life's strong heart forth and be free. Then help, as if a beast had left its prey, a moment in a wave of rich relief, reborn to strength and happy ease, he stood rejoicing and resumed his confident toil, but with less seeing strokes. Now the great woodsman yelled at him, and his labor ceased. Lifting his arm, he flung away the poignant axe far from him like an instrument of pain. She came to him in silent anguish and clasp, and he cried to her, "Savitri, a pang cleaves through my head and breast, as if the axe were piercing it and not the living branch. Such agony rends me as the tree must feel when it is sundered and must lose its life. A while, let me lay my head upon thy lap and guard me with thy hands from evil fate. Perhaps because thou touchest, death may pass."
Thank you. Dawn.
Then Savitri sat under branches white, cool, green against the sun. Not the herb tree which has seen axe had cloven, that she shunned, but leaned beneath the fortunate kingly trunk. She guarded him in her bosom and strove to soothe his anguished brow and body with her hands. All grief and fear were dead within her now, and a great calm had fallen. The wish to lessen his suffering, the impulse that opposes pain, were the one mortal feeling left. Briefless and strong, she waited like the gods. But now his sweet familiar hue was changed into a tarnished grayness, and his eyes dimmed over, forsaken of the clear light she loved. Only the dull and physical mind was left, vacant of the bright spirit's luminous gaze. But once before it faded wholly back, he cried out in a clinging last despair, "Savitri, Savitri, oh Savitri, lean down my soul and kiss me while I die." And even as her pallid lips pressed his, his failed, lossing last sweetness of response, his cheek pressed down her golden arm. She sought his mouth, still with her living mouth, as if she could persuade his soul back with her kiss. Then grew rare
they were no more alone.
Thank you. Betty.
Something had come there, conscious, vast and dire. Near her, she felt a silent shade immense, chilling the noon with darkness for its back. An awful hush had fallen upon the place. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beasts. But terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. A cosmic mind looked out on all from formidable eyes, condemning all with its unbearable gaze, and with immortal lids and a vast brow, it saw in its immense destroying thought all things and beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight, the wordless meaning of its deep regard, voicing the unreality of things, and life that would be forever, but never was, and its brief and vain recurrence without cease. As if from a silence without form or name, the shadow of a remote, uncaring God, doomed to his naught the illusory universe, canceling its show of idea and act in time, and its imitation of eternity. She knew that visible death was standing there, and Satyavan had passed from her reigning place.
Thank you.
Is there a misspelling?
What?
A misspelling.
Where?
Line 161, line 162. Shouldn't that T be a D?
Contemning. Contemning.
It's a word.
It is a word. It means condemning, but with contempt.
That makes great sense.
It's nice, huh? But it's in the dictionary, you will find it.
Not too many words.
Say a couple words about looking at this on that line, changing the legend versus the symbol.
Yes.
This is very easy to pull into the story of the legend, but in fact it is symbol.
It's very interesting that, as I said, very few lines have been changed from the legend stage of the composition. In 1916, when the first version was written, it was called, I forget what it was called, but it wasn't called a symbol. It wasn't called a legend and a symbol.
Yeah.
I think it was called a tale and a vision. That's what it was. Savitri, a tale and a vision. So yes, throughout part two, we are very close to the legend aspect and very strongly here. And actually, Sri Aurobindo only added 18 lines to pull it into the symbol, to connect it to the symbol. He added those at a late stage in the late 40s. 18 lines. Something had come there conscious, vast and dire, middle of page 565. And then the next two lines were, she knew that visible death was standing there, and Satyavan had passed from her embrace. But to link that earlier vision with his later intention of showing here the symbolism of ignorance and death, marvelous lines, these 18 lines characterizing this power that now Savitri is going to have to confront through the next three cantos. Just a minute, yeah?
Which line?
It's from line 154 to 175. Late, yeah. I can't tell you exactly when. If you, there's Richard Hartz's series of articles on the composition of Savitri. They've been published in Mother India, and we've got the off prints here. And these are the kind of things that he points out. Mm.
To me, the symbolism of this is that this idea that was extant around this time that Schrodinger was writing Savitri was the idea that there was no soul, there was only emptiness. I mean, that was the goal. And this soul thing is an illusion. Many people had this idea. They used to say God was dead when I was in America. So this, to me, is the real death, you know, and that's why Satyavan must die. They have to go through this, and Sri Aurobindo then has to have the Divine Mother come down and save the whole situation. Because the creation is that the four powers had turned into their opposites.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the death of the soul. There was no soul until she came down and planted herself there, isn't it?
Yes.
So if people realize that that's what their life is until they wake up to their soul, then their life is a failure. Mother said their life is a failure only if you haven't found your soul.
And death represents that view of things.
Yeah.
That view of
things. Yes.
That's what he tries to say, you know. Give up this fellow Satyavan. She says, no, I will not give up my soul. That's
so death is a cosmic mind that's looking out from these powerful, terrifying eyes of his, and he's contemning everything. Mm-hmm. He's dismissing, condemning, and full of contempt for all this illusory appearances, this unbearable gaze. In its immense destroying thought, it saw all things and beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight.
Satyavan will prove him wrong.
Savitri will prove him wrong.
Satyavan, he can't do much.
Savitri will prove him wrong.
Yes. 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 There's a, that's what happens next. He tests her. He tests every aspect of her sadhana. You've done your yoga now. Show me.
Show me.
Mm? And first, there's the passage through the Book of Eternal Night, towards the black void, and then the journey in eternal night. And then we come to book 10, which is the book of the double twilight. And that has first the dream twilight of the ideal. It's a beautiful world, but in the next canto, death tries to prove to her that every ideal is just vanity, the gospel of death and vanity of the ideal.
Does death explain, though, how whatever he thinks contemptuously that we are, how that got here, if we're just simply nothing?
He says, I made it.
Oh,
I've made it all. Yes. Yes. And then comes her reply, which is what we're reading on Thursdays at the moment. The debate of love and death. And having disposed of him, more or less, they pass on to the dream twilight of the earthly real, which is all our illusions. And I remember when we were reading this the last time around, we had the Italian Gino with us, and he pointed out, he said, when death speaks, that's what we believe. He exactly voices our just our usual thoughts. So we have to pay a lot of attention to that. And in reply to him, Savitri says, Death, you are telling the truth that slays, that destroys. I'm going to give you the truth that saves.
Mm. And it's so important in today's world because this jihad philosophy is exactly this thing, destroying. So this class to me is very important. The study of Savitri is affirmation of the soul.
Yeah. And then I won't say anything about book 11 because we just have to explore this.
We come to the crux of the matter.
No, you have the feeling that by the time we come to book end of book 10, all the answers have been given. But still, she's not able to take Satyavan back to the earth. For that, she has to go much higher. So maybe we stop there today. And then, yeah, sure, if you've got it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The last time we read it, Manohar asked me a question about this line, the shadow of a remote, uncaring God, doomed to his naught, the illusory universe, cancelling its show of idea and act in time and its imitation of eternity. And that set me off on a very fascinating piece of research.
Verse 3.
Why don't we listen to them all?
Oh, we can do.
We've got time.
Yes. Yes.
Hmm?
The mother is reading quite a lot of
that. Yes. Yeah, because it's it was by this time it was Huta who was selecting the lines, and this is a legend, and it's rather easy to choose the pictures. Actually, it was never mother who chose the lines. I have to say this. That at the beginning, she asked Huta to paint the paintings. But the lines, I think in the very beginning, they were perhaps chosen by Purani. And then he got ill and died, and Amalkiran started suggesting the lines. And then at a certain stage, Mother said to Huta, you choose. So about the middle of the poem somewhere.
Okay, yes,
sir. Yeah. Either of you. Come, Marianne.
What line?
Now we're going back to the beginning of the canto, and from the death in the forest, and from this, Mother reads seven different passages, so we can hear them all. Yeah.
In my book, five lines are missing.
How strange. Let me have a look at your book. Oh, it is, yes.
Oh,
that was your problem. Yes, somebody came to me with this problem before. This is, it was you, Tara. Yes, you have this same edition published by Vark, I don't know, in the 80s sometime.
Yes,
yeah,
70s.
So I can only advise you to get a new one.
Silently she holds, and service done, bow down to the great goddess, simply carved by Sephira upon the forest stone. What prayer she believes her soul and daughter know. Perhaps she felt in the dream forest too, the infinite mother watching over her
But as he worked,
his doom upon him came. Now the great woodsman shoot at him, and his labor ceased. Lifting his arm, he flung away the poisoned axe. Far from him, like an instrument of pain, she came to him in silent anguish and clasped, and he cried to her, sultry, a pang cleaves through my head and breast, as if the axe were piercing it and not the living bone. Then Savitri sat under branches wide. She guarded him in her and strove to soothe his anguished brow and body with her hand. He cried out in a clinging last despair, Savitri, Savitri, oh Savitri, lean down my soul and kiss me while I die.
Thanks to Shobindo.